In early September, with the virus killing 5% of all Philadelphia Navy personnel who showed any symptoms of influenza at all, that pressure had intensified. Since then, he and everyone under him had hardly left their laboratories to go home. Finding B. influenzae had begun his real work, not concluded it. Never had he been so consumed with the laboratory. He had started his experiments with the pneumococcus. He had begun to explore the possibility that a filterable virus caused influenza. He had continued to look at the influenza bacillus. He and others had developed a vaccine. He was trying to make a serum. All of these he did simultaneously, for the one thing he did not have was time. No one had time. If Lewis had a scientific weakness, it was that he too willingly accepted guidance from those he respected. Once, when he asked for more direction from Flexner, Flexner had rebuffed him, saying, "I much prefer that you arrange plans. I have not planned specifically for your time, but much prefer to leave the direction of it to you." Lewis respected Flexner. He respected Richard Pfeiffer as well. In the overwhelming majority of cases, he was now finding Pfeiffer's B. influenzae in swabs from living patients, in autopsied lungs. He was not finding it alone, necessarily, or always. It was not certain proof, but more and more he was coming to believe that this bacterium did, in fact, cause disease. And, under the pressure of time, he abandoned his investigation into the possibility that a filterable virus caused influenza. Yet, he loved this. Although he hated the disease, he loved this. He believed he had been born to do this. He loved working deep into the night amid rows of glassware, monitoring the growth of bacteria in 100 flasks and petri dishes, running 12 experiments in staggered fashion, coordinating them like the conductor of a symphony. He even loved the unexpected result that could throw everything off. The only thing Lewis disliked about his position as head of an institute was charming the fine families of Philadelphia out of philanthropic donations, attending their parties and performing as their pet scientist. The laboratory was where he had always belonged. Now he was in it hours and hours each day. He believed he had spent too much time mixing with the fine families of Philadelphia. In fact, those fine families of the city deserved more respect. They were about to take charge. The writer Christopher Morley once said that Philadelphia lies at the confluence of the Biddle and Drexel families. In 1918, that description was not far wrong. Of all the major cities in the United States, Philadelphia had a real claim to being the most American. It certainly had the largest percentage of native-born Americans of major cities and, compared to New York, Chicago, Boston, Detroit, Buffalo, and similar cities, the lowest percentage of immigrants. Philadelphia was not unusual in that its oldest and wealthiest families controlled the charities, the social service organizations, including the local Red Cross, and the Pennsylvania Council of National Defense. But now, with the city government all but non-existent, it was unusual in that these families considered it their duty to use the Council of National Defense to take charge. Nationally, that organization had been the vehicle through which, before the war, Wilson had laid plans to control the economy, using it to assemble data from across the country on factories, transportation, labor, and natural resources. But each state had its own council, which were often dominated by his political enemies. Once the war started, Wilson created new federal institutions, sidestepped this organization, and it lost power. The Pennsylvania Council, however, retained extraordinary, although almost entirely unofficial, influence over everything from railroad schedules to profits and wages at every large company in the state, even though it too was run by Wilson's enemies. It held this power chiefly because it was headed by George Wharton Pepper. No one had better bloodlines. His great-great-grandfather had led the state militia in the Revolutionary War. His wife was a descendant of Benjamin Franklin, and a statue of his Uncle William, who had worked closely with Welch to reform medical education and brought Flexner to the University of Pennsylvania, today sits astride the grand stairway of the Free Library in downtown Philadelphia. George Wharton Pepper had ability as well. An attorney who sat on the boards of half a dozen of the country's largest companies, he was not ruthless, but he knew how to command. An indication of his stature had come a few months earlier when he received one of three honorary degrees awarded by Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. His fellow honorees were J.P. Morgan and former President of the United States and soon-to-be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Howard Taft. The Philadelphia office of the State Council of National Defense was run by Judge J. Willis Martin. His wife, Elizabeth, had organized the country's first garden club and was largely responsible for making Rittenhouse Square a green spot in the city. She also headed the council's women's division as well as emergency aid, the most important private social agency in the city. Nearly all the social agencies were run by women. Strong women of intelligence and energy and born to a certain rank, but excluded from all pursuits beside charity. The mayor had created a committee of society women to respond to emergencies. It included Pepper's wife along with Mrs. John Wanamaker, Mrs. Edward Stotesbury, whose husband was the city's leading banker and head of Drexel & Company, and Mrs. Edward Biddle, president of the Civic Club and whose husband was descended from Nicholas Biddle, creator of the first Bank of the United States, which, to his nemesis Andrew Jackson, embodied the sinister, moneyed power of the nation. These women despised the Vare machine and had cooperated only to show unity during the war. But with city officials doing nothing whatsoever about the epidemic, the women resigned, effectively dissolving the committee. As Elizabeth Martin wrote the mayor, "Your committee has no real purpose. I therefore hereby sever my connection with it." Now, in place of the city government, Pepper, the Martins, and their colleagues summoned the heads of a dozen private organizations on October 7th to the headquarters of emergency aid at 1428 Walnut Street. There, the women took charge, with Pepper adding his weight to theirs. To sell war bonds, they had already organized nearly the entire city, all the way down to the level of each block, making each residential block the responsibility of a logical leader no matter what her nationality. That is, an Irish woman in an Irish neighborhood, an African-American woman in an African-American neighborhood, and so on. They intended to use that same organization now to distribute everything from medical care to food. They intended to inject organization and leadership into chaos and panic. In conjunction with the Red Cross, which here, unlike nearly everywhere else in the country, allowed its own efforts to be incorporated into this larger emergency aid, they also appealed for nurses, declaring the death toll for one day in Philadelphia alone was greater than the death toll from France for the whole American army for one day. The State Council of National Defense had already compiled a list of every physician in Pennsylvania, including those not practicing. Martin's ad hoc committee beseeched each one on the list for help. The committee had money and access to more money to pay for the help. It set up a 24-hour telephone bank at Strawbridge and Clothier, which donated use of its phone lines. Newspapers and placards urged people to call Filbert 100 24 hours a day for information and referrals. It transformed kitchens in public schools, which were closed, into soup kitchens that prepared meals for tens of thousands of people too ill to prepare their own. It divided the city into seven districts and, to conserve physicians' time, dispatched them according to geography, meaning that doctors did not see their own patients. And it became a place that volunteers could come to. Nearly 500 people offered to use their own cars either as ambulances or to chauffeur doctors. They were supplied with green flags that gave them right of way over all other vehicles. The organizers of the Liberty Loan Drive diverted another 400 cars to help. Thousands of individuals called the headquarters and offered to do what was needed. Crewson had not attended the October 7th meeting of the private groups and had been slow to act before. Now he changed. Perhaps the deaths finally changed him. Perhaps the fact that someone else was taking charge forced him to move. But he seemed suddenly not to care about the Vares, or selling war bonds, or bureaucracy, or his own power. He just wanted to stop the disease. He ceded to the group control over all nurses, hundreds of them who worked for the city. He seized, in violation of the city charter, the city's $100,000 emergency fund and another $25,000 from a war emergency fund, and used the money to supply emergency hospitals and hire physicians, paying them double what the public health service was offering. He sent those physicians to every police station in South Philadelphia, the hardest hit section. He wired the Army and Navy asking that no Philadelphia physicians be drafted until the epidemic abated, and that those who had already been drafted but had not yet reported to duty be allowed to remain in Philadelphia, because the death rate for the past week was the largest in records of city. The U.S. Public Health Service still had no presence in Philadelphia and had done nothing for it. Now Rupert Blue did the only thing he would do for the city in its distress. He wired the Surgeon General of the Navy to heartily endorse Crewson's request. The deaths spoke far more loudly than Blue. The military did allow Philadelphia to keep its doctors. Crewson also cleaned the streets. The streets of South Philadelphia literally stank of rot and excrement. Victorians had considered it axiomatic that filthy streets per se were linked to disease. The most modern public health experts, Charles Chapin in Providence, Biggs in New York, and others, flatly rejected that idea. But Dr. Howard Anders, who earlier had been ignored by the press when he warned that the Liberty Loan Parade would spread influenza, was given page one by the Ledger on October 10th to state, "Dirty streets. Filth allowed to collect and stand until, germ-laden and disease-breeding, it is carried, broadcast with the first gust of wind. There you have one of the greatest causes of the terrible epidemic." Other Philadelphia doctors agreed. The condition of the streets spreads the epidemic. So Crewson sent trucks and men down them with their water sprays and sweepers almost daily, doing the job Vare had been paid for many times, but had never done. Crewson, emergency aid, and the Catholic Church teamed up to do one more thing, the most important thing. They began to clear the bodies. The corpses had backed up at undertakers, filling every area of these establishments and pressing up into living quarters. In hospital morgues, overflowing into corridors. In the city morgue, overflowing into the street. And they had backed up in homes. They lay on porches, in closets, in corners of the floor, on beds. Children would sneak away from adults to stare at them, to touch them. A wife would lie next to a dead husband, unwilling to move him or leave him. The corpses, reminders of death and bringers of terror or grief, lay under ice at Indian summer temperatures. Their presence was constant, a horror demoralizing the city, a horror that could not be escaped. Finally, the city tried to catch up to them. Crewson sent police to clear homes of bodies that had remained there for more than a day, piling them in patrol wagons, but they could not keep up with the dying and fell further behind. The police wore their ghostly surgical masks, and people fled them. But the masks had no effect on the viruses, and by mid-October, 33 policemen had died, with many more to follow. Crewson opened a supplementary morgue at a cold storage plant at 20th and Cambridge Streets. He would open five more supplementary morgues. He begged military embalmers from the Army. Pepper and Martin convinced the Brill Company, which made streetcars, to build thousands of simple boxes for coffins, and they gathered students from embalming schools and morticians from as far as 150 miles away. More coffins came by rail, guarded by men with guns. And graves were dug. First, the families of the dead picked up shovels and dug into the earth, faces streaked with sweat and tears and grit. For gravediggers would not work. The city's official annual report notes that undertakers found it impossible to hire persons willing to handle the bodies, owing to the decomposed nature of the same. When Anna Lavin's aunt died, they took her to the cemetery. My father took me and the boy, who also had the flu, and he was wrapped. My father carried him, wrapped in a blanket, to the cemetery to say the prayer for the dead. The families had to dig their own graves. That was the terrible thing. Pepper and Martin offered $10 a day to anyone who would touch a corpse, but that proved inadequate, and still the bodies piled up. Seminary students volunteered as gravediggers, but they still could not keep pace. The city and archdiocese turned to construction equipment, using steam shovels to dig trenches for mass graves. Michael Donahue, an undertaker, said, "They brought a steam shovel into Holy Cross Cemetery and actually excavated. They would begin bringing caskets in and doing the committal prayers right in the trench, and they'd line them up right in, one right after another." This was their answer to helping the families get through things. The bodies that were choking homes and lying in stacks in mortuaries were ready to go, finally, into the ground. To collect them, Archbishop Dennis Doherty, installed in office only a few weeks earlier, later he became the first cardinal from the archdiocese, sent priests down the streets to remove bodies from homes. They joined the police and a few hardy others who were doing the same. Sometimes they collected the bodies in trucks. So many people died they were instructed to ask for wooden boxes and put the corpse on the front porches, recalled Harriet Farrell. An open truck came through the neighborhood and picked up the bodies. There was no place to put them. There was not room. And sometimes they collected the bodies in wagons. Selma Epp's brother Daniel died. People were being placed on these horse-drawn wagons, and my aunt saw the wagons pass by, and he was placed on the wagon. Everyone was too weak to protest. There were no coffins in the wagon, but the people who had died were wrapped in a sort of sackcloth and placed in the wagon. One was on top of the other. There were so many bodies. They were drawn by horses, and the wagons took the bodies away. No one could look at the trucks and carts carrying bodies. Bodies wrapped in cloth, stacked loosely on other bodies wrapped in cloth, arms and legs protruding, bodies heading for cemeteries to be buried in trenches, or hear the keening of the mourners and the call for the dead, and not think of another plague, the plague of the Middle Ages. Under the initial burst of energy, the city seemed at first to rally, to respond with vigor and courage now that leadership and organization seemed in place. But the epidemic did not abate. The street cleaning accomplished nothing, at least regarding influenza, and the coroner, Vare's man, blamed the increasing death toll on the ban by the state public health commissioner on liquor sales, claiming alcohol was the best treatment for influenza. In virtually every home, someone was ill. People were already avoiding each other, turning their heads away if they had to talk, isolating themselves. The telephone company increased the isolation. With 1,800 telephone company employees out, the phone company allowed only emergency calls. Operators listened to calls randomly and cut off phone service of those who made routine calls. And the isolation increased the fear. Clifford Adams recalled, "They stopped people from communicating, from going to churches, closed the schools, closed all the saloons. Everything was quiet." Very likely, 500,000, possibly more, Philadelphians fell sick. It is impossible to be more precise. Despite the new legal requirement to report cases, physicians were far too busy to do so, and by no means did physicians see all victims. Nor did nurses. People needed help, and notwithstanding the efforts of emergency aid, the Council of National Defense, and the Red Cross, help was impossible to get. The Inquirer blared in headlines, "Scientific Nursing Halting Epidemic." But there were no nurses. The log of a single organization that sent out nurses noted without comment, "The number of calls received, 2,955, and calls not filled, 2,758. Calls received, 2,955. Calls not filled, 2,758. And the report pointed out that even those numbers, 93% of the calls unfilled, 7% filled, was an understatement, since the calls received does not represent the number of nurses required, for many of the calls were for several nurses to go to one place, two of the calls being for 50 nurses each. Those nurses were needed, needed desperately. One study of 55 flu victims who were not hospitalized found that not one was ever seen by a nurse or a doctor. 10 of the 55 patients died. It now seemed as if there had never been life before the epidemic. The disease informed every action of every person in the city. The Archbishop released nuns for service in hospitals, including Jewish hospitals, and allowed them to violate rules of their orders, to spend overnight away from the convent, to break vows of silence. They did not make a dent in the need. By then, many of those who had earlier rushed forward to volunteer had withdrawn. The work was too gruesome, or too arduous, or they themselves fell ill, or they were too frightened. Everyday newspapers carried new and increasingly desperate pleas for volunteers. On the single day of October 10th, the epidemic alone killed 759 people in Philadelphia. Prior to the outbreak, deaths from all causes, all illnesses, all accidents, all suicides, and all murders averaged 485 a week. Fear began to break down the community of the city. Trust broke down. Signs began to surface of not just edginess, but anger. Not just finger-pointing or protecting one's own interests, but active selfishness in the face of general calamity. The hundreds of thousands sick in the city became a great weight dragging upon it, and the city began to implode in chaos and fear. Pleas for volunteers became increasingly plaintive and increasingly strident. Under the headline, "Emergency Aid Calls for Amateur Nurses," newspapers printed Mrs. Martin's request. "In this desperate crisis, the emergency aid calls on all who are free from the care of the sick at home and who are in good physical condition themselves to report at 1428 Walnut Street as early as possible Sunday morning. The office will be open all day and recruits will be enrolled and immediately sent out on emergency work." Crewson declared, "It is the duty of every well woman in the city who can possibly get away from her duties to volunteer for this emergency." But who listened to him anymore? Mrs. Martin called for help from all persons with two hands and a willingness to work. Few came. On October 13th, the Bureau of Child Hygiene publicly begged for neighbors to take in, at least temporarily, children whose parents were dying or dead. The response was almost nil. Elizabeth Martin pleaded, "We simply must have more volunteer helpers. We have ceased caring for ordinary cases of the disease. These people are almost all at the point of death. Won't you ask every able-bodied woman in Philadelphia whether or not she has any experience in nursing to come to our help?" Few replied. The need was not only for medical care, but for care itself. Entire families were ill and had no one to feed them. Crewson pleaded publicly, Every healthy woman in the city who can possibly be spared from her home can be used in fighting the epidemic. But by now the city had heard enough pleas and had turned into itself. There was no trust. No trust. And without trust, all human relations were breaking down. The professionals had continued to do their duty. One physician at Philadelphia Hospital, a woman, had said she was certain she was going to die if she remained, and fled. But that was a rarity. Doctors died, and others kept working. Nurses died, and others kept working. Philadelphia Hospital had 20 student nurses from Vassar. Already 2 had died, but the others have behaved splendidly. They say they will work all the harder. Other professionals did their jobs as well. The police performed with heroism. Before the epidemic, they had too often acted like a private army that owed its allegiance to the Wehrmachine. They had stood almost alone in the country against the Navy's crackdown on prostitution near military facilities. Yet when the police department was asked for 4 volunteers to remove bodies from beds, put them in coffins, and load them in vehicles, when the police knew that many of those bodies had decomposed, 118 officers responded. But citizens in general had largely stopped responding. Many women had reported to an emergency hospital for a single shift. They had never returned. Some had disappeared in the middle of a shift. On October 16th, the chief nurse at the city's largest hospital told an advisory council, "Volunteers in the wards are useless. They are afraid. Many people have volunteered and then refused to have anything to do with patients." The attrition rate, even where volunteers did not come into contact with the sick, in the kitchens, for example, was little better. Finally, Mrs. Martin turned bitter and contemptuous. "Hundreds of women who are content to sit back had delightful dreams of themselves in the roles of angels of mercy, had the unfathomable vanity to imagine that they were capable of great spirit of sacrifice. Nothing seems to rouse them now. They have been told that there are families in which every member is ill, in which the children are actually starving because there is no one to give them food. The death rate is so high, and they still hold back." Susanna Turner, who did volunteer at an emergency hospital and stayed, who went there day after day, remembered, "The fear in the hearts of the people just withered them. They were afraid to go out, afraid to do anything. You just lived from day to day, did what you had to do and not think about the future. If you asked a neighbor for help, they wouldn't do so because they weren't taking any chances. If they didn't have it in their house, they weren't going to bring it in there. You didn't have the same spirit of charity that you do with a regular time. When someone was sick, you'd go and help them. But at that time, they helped themselves. It was a horror-stricken time." The professionals were heroes. The physicians and nurses and medical students and student nurses, who were all dying in large numbers themselves, held nothing of themselves back. And there were others. Ira Thomas played catcher for the Philadelphia Athletics. The baseball season had been shortened by Crowder's work-or-fight order, since sport was deemed unnecessary labor. Thomas's wife was a 6-foot-tall woman, large-boned, strong. They had no children. Day after day, he carried the sick in his car to hospitals, and she worked in an emergency hospital. Of course, there were others, but they were few. "Help out," said Susanna Turner. "They weren't going to risk it. They just refused because they were so panic-stricken. They really were. They feared their relatives would die because so many did die. They just dropped dead." No one could buy things. Commodities dealers, coal dealers, grocers closed because the people who dealt in them were either sick or afraid, and they had reason to be afraid. During the week of October 16th alone, 4,597 Philadelphians died from influenza or pneumonia, and influenza killed still more indirectly. That would be the worst week of the epidemic. but no one knew that at the time. Crewson had too often said the peak had passed. The press had too often spoken of triumph over disease. Even war industries, despite the massive propaganda campaigns telling workers victory depended upon their production, saw massive absences. Anna Lavin said, "We didn't work. Couldn't go to work. Nobody came in to work. Even those who weren't sick stayed in. They were all afraid." Between 20% and 40% of the workers at Baldwin Locomotive, at Midvale Steel, at Sun Shipbuilding, each plant employing thousands, were absent. At virtually every large employer, huge percentages of employees were absent. 3,800 Pennsylvania Railroad workers were out. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad set up its own emergency hospitals along its tracks. The entire transportation system for the Mid-Atlantic region staggered and trembled, putting in jeopardy most of the nation's industrial output. The city was breaking apart. Orphans were already becoming a problem. Social service agencies that tried but fell short in their efforts to deliver food and transport people to hospitals began to plan for the orphans as well. Chapter 29. What was happening in Philadelphia was happening everywhere. In that densely populated city, Isaac Starr had counted not a single other car on the road in his 12-mile drive from the city center home. And on the other side of the world, the same experiences. The deaths, the terror, the reluctance to help, the silence were replicated. Alfred Hollows was in Wellington, New Zealand. I was detailed to an emergency hospital in Abel Smith Street. It was a hall staffed by women volunteers. They had 60 beds. Our death rate was really quite appalling. Something like a dozen a day. And the women volunteers just disappeared and weren't seen again. I stood in the middle of Wellington City at 2 p.m. on a weekday afternoon, and there was not a soul to be seen. No trams running, no shops open, and the only traffic was a van with a white sheet tied to the side, with a big red cross painted on it, serving as an ambulance or hearse. It was really a city of the dead. In New York City at Presbyterian Hospital, each morning on rounds, Dr. Dana Atchley was astounded and frightened to see that, for what seemed to him an eternity, every single patient, every one in the critical section, had died overnight. The federal government was giving no guidance that a reasoning person could credit. Few local governments did better. They left a vacuum. Fear filled it. The government's very efforts to preserve morale fostered the fear, for since the war began, morale, defined in the narrowest, most short-sighted fashion, had taken precedence in every public utterance. As California Senator Hiram Johnson said in 1917, "The first casualty when war comes is truth." It was a time when the phrase brisk fighting meant that more than 50% of a unit was killed or wounded. A time when the memoir of a nurse at the front, published in 1916, was withdrawn by her publisher after America entered the war because she told the truth about gruesome conditions. A time when newspapers insisted there is plenty of gasoline and oil for automobile use, even while gas stations were ordered to close voluntarily at night and Sundays, and a national campaign was being waged against driving on gasless Sundays, and police pulled over motorists who did not voluntarily comply. Newspapers reported on the disease with the same mixture of truth and half-truth, truth and distortion, truth and lies with which they reported everything else. And no national official ever publicly acknowledged the danger of influenza. But in the medical community, deep concern had arisen. Welch, of course, had initially feared that it might be a new disease, although he soon recognized it as influenza. Many serious pathologists in Germany and Switzerland considered the possibility of plague. The director of the laboratory at Bellevue Hospital wondered in the Journal of the American Medical Association if the world is facing not a pandemic of an extraordinarily lethal influenza, but instead a mild version of plague, noting the similarity of the two diseases is enforced by the clinical features, which are remarkably alike in many respects, and by the pathology of certain tissues other than the lungs. What pathologists said in medical journals, physicians muttered to each other, while laymen and women watched a husband or wife turning almost black. And a great chill settled over the land, a chill of fear. Meanwhile, William Park sat in his laboratory amid petri dishes, dissected mice, and cultures of pathogens, and quoted Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. In the whole, the face of things, as I say, was much altered. Sorrow and sadness sat upon every face. And though some parts were not yet overwhelmed, yet all looked deeply concerned. And as we saw it apparently coming on, so everyone looked on himself and his family as in the utmost danger. As terrifying as the disease was, the press made it more so. They terrified by making little of it, for what officials and the press said bore no relationship to what people saw and touched and smelled and endured. People could not trust what they read. Uncertainty follows distrust, fear follows uncertainty, and under conditions such as these, terror follows fear. When influenza struck in Massachusetts, the nearby Providence Journal reported, "All the hospital beds at the forts at Boston Harbor are occupied by influenza patients. There are 3,500 cases at Camp Devens." Yet the paper asserted, "Such reports may actually be reassuring rather than alarming. The soldier or sailor goes to bed if he is told to, just as he goes on sentry duty. He may not think he is sick, and he may be right about it, but the military doctor is not to be argued with, and at this time the autocrat is not permitting the young men under his charge to take any chance." As the virus infested the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, the Associated Press reported, "To dispel alarm caused throughout the country by exaggerated stories, Captain W.A. Moffat, Commandant, gave out the statement today that while there are about 4,500 cases of the disease among the 45,000 blue jackets at the station, the situation in general is much improved. The death rate has been only 1.5%, which is below the death rate in the East." That report was meant to reassure. It is unlikely that it did so, even though it omitted the fact that quarantines were being imposed upon the training station, the adjoining Great Lakes Aviation Camp, and the nearby Fort Sheridan Army Cantonment, which, combined, amounted to the largest military concentration in the country. And military authorities, of course, assured both civilians nearby as well as the country at large that the epidemic is on the wane. Over and over, in hundreds of newspapers, day after day, repeated in one form or another, people read Rupert Blue's reassurance as well. There is no cause for alarm if precautions are observed. They read the words of Colonel Philip Doan, the officer in charge of health at the country's shipyards, who told the Associated Press, "The so-called Spanish influenza is nothing more or less than old-fashioned grip." Those words, too, ran in hundreds of newspapers. But people could smell death in them. Then they came to know that death. Immediately outside Little Rock lay Camp Pike, where 8,000 cases were admitted to the hospital in 4 days, and the camp commandant stopped releasing the names of the dead. "You ought to see this hospital tonight," wrote Francis Blake, one of four members of the Army's pneumonia commission at Pike. "Every corridor, and there are miles of them, with a double row of cots, and every ward nearly with an extra row down the middle with influenza patients, and lots of barracks about the camp turned into emergency infirmaries, and the camp closed. There is only death and destruction." The camp called upon Little Rock for nurses, doctors, linens, and coffins, all while within the city the Arkansas Gazette declared in headlines, "Spanish influenza is plain la grippe, same old fever and chills." Outside Des Moines, Iowa, at Camp Dodge also, influenza was killing hundreds of young soldiers. Within the city, a group called the Greater Des Moines Committee, businessmen and professionals who had taken charge during the emergency, included the city attorney who warned publishers, and his warning carried the sting of potential prosecution, "I would recommend that if anything be printed in regard to the disease, it be confined to simple preventive measures, something constructive rather than destructive." Another committee member, a physician, said, "There is no question that by a right attitude of the mind, these people have kept themselves from illness. I have no doubt that many persons have contracted the disease through fear. Fear is the first thing to be overcome, the first step in conquering this epidemic." The Bronxville, New York, Review Press and Reporter simply said nothing at all about influenza, absolutely nothing, until October 4th. When it reported that the scourge had claimed its first victim there. It was as if the scourge had come from nowhere. Yet even the paper recognized that, without its printing a word, everyone knew of it. And even as the epidemic rooted itself in Bronxville, the paper condemned alarmism and warned, "Fear kills more than the disease, and the weak and timid often succumb first." Fear. That was the enemy. Yes, fear. And the more officials tried to control it with half-truths and outright lies, the more the terror spread. The Los Angeles public health director said, "If ordinary precautions are observed, there is no cause for alarm." 48 hours later, he closed all places of public gatherings, including schools, churches, and theaters. The Illinois Superintendent of Public Health had, privately, in a confidential meeting with other Illinois public health officials and Chicago politicians, suggested they close all places of business to save lives. Chicago Public Health Commissioner John Dill Robertson violently rejected that suggestion as unwarranted and very damaging to morale. In his official report on the epidemic, he bragged, "Nothing was done to interfere with the morale of the community." Later he explained to other public health professionals, "It is our duty to keep the people from fear. Worry kills more people than the epidemic." The mortality rate at Cook County Hospital for all influenza cases, not just those who developed pneumonia, was 39.8%. Literary Digest, one of the largest circulation periodicals in the country, advised, "Fear is our first enemy." "Don't get scared," was the advice printed in virtually every newspaper in the country, in large, blocked-off parts of pages labeled, "Advice on How to Avoid Influenza." The Albuquerque Morning Journal issued instructions on how to dodge flu. The most prominent advice was the usual, "Don't get scared." Almost daily, it repeated, "Don't let flu frighten you to death. Don't panic." In Phoenix, the Arizona Republican monitored influenza from a distance. On September 22nd, it declared, "Dr. W.C. Woodward of the Boston Health Department assumed an optimistic attitude tonight. Dr. Woodward said the increase in cases today was not alarming." At Camp Dix, the camp medical authorities asserted they have the epidemic under control. And the paper noted the first influenza deaths in New Orleans 2 days before the New Orleans daily newspaper, The Item, mentioned any death in the city. But after the first case appeared in Phoenix itself, the Republican fell silent, utterly silent, saying nothing about influenza any place in the country until the news was such that it could no longer keep silent. Its competitor, the Gazette, competed in reassurances, quoting local physician Herman Randall saying, 10 people sit in the same draft, are exposed to the same microbes. Some will suffer and perhaps die, while the others go scot-free. The people during an epidemic who are most fearful are usually, on the testimony of physicians, the first ones to succumb to the disease. And in Phoenix, even after the war ended, the Citizens Committee that had taken over the city during the emergency continued to impose silence, ordering that merchants of the city refrain from mentioning the influenza epidemic directly or indirectly in their advertising. Meanwhile, Vicks VapoRub advertisements in hundreds of papers danced down the delicate line of reassurance while promising relief, calling the epidemic simply the old-fashioned grip masquerading under a new name. Some papers experimented in controlling fear by printing almost nothing at all. In Goldsboro, North Carolina, recalls a survivor, the papers didn't even want to publish the lists of names of the dead. The information about who was dying had to come up through the grapevine, verbally, from one person to the other. A historian studying Buffalo County, Nebraska, expressed puzzlement that the county newspapers manifested a curious reticence regarding the effects of influenza, perhaps most evident in the Kearney Hub. It may be surmised that the editors played down the severity of the problem to discourage the onset of general panic in the face of what was a thoroughly frightening situation. As late as December 14th, that paper was telling people not to get panicky, telling them city officials were not inclined to be as panicky as a great many citizens. How could one not get panicky? Even before people's neighbors began to die, before bodies began to pile up in each new community, every piece of information except the newspapers told the truth. Even while Blue recited his mantra, "There is no cause for alarm if proper precautions are taken," he was calling upon local authorities to close all public gathering places if their community is threatened with the epidemic. This will do much toward checking the spread of the disease. Even if Colonel Doan had said influenza is nothing more or less than old-fashioned grip, newspapers also quoted him saying, "Every person who spits is helping the Kaiser." And even while Blue and Doan, governors and mayors, and nearly all the newspapers insisted that this was influenza, only influenza, the Public Health Service was making a massive effort to distribute advice. Nearly useless advice. It prepared ready-to-print plates and sent them to 10,000 newspapers, most of which did print them. It prepared. The Red Cross paid for printing and distribution, posters and pamphlets, including 6 million copies of a single circular. Teachers handed them out in schools. Bosses stacked them in stores, post offices, and factories. Boy Scouts stuffed them into tens of thousands of doorways. Ministers referred to them on Sundays. Mailmen carried them to rural free delivery boxes. City workers pasted posters to walls. But a Public Health Service warning to avoid crowds came too late to do much good, and the only advice of any real use remained the same: that those who felt sick should go to bed immediately and stay there several days after all symptoms disappeared. Everything else in Blue's circulars was so general as to be pointless. Yet all over the country, newspapers printed again and again, "Remember the three C's: clean mouth, clean skin, and clean clothes. Keep the bowels open. Food will win the war. Help by choosing and chewing your food well." The Journal of the American Medical Association knew better. It dismissed the public reassurances and warned, "The danger to life from influenza in this epidemic is so grave that it is imperative to secure from the individual patient the most complete isolation." And it attacked current advice and instructions to the public from the official and other sources. Blue's advice, the advice from local public health officials downplaying everything as useless and dangerous. "Don't get scared," said the newspapers. Meanwhile, people read, those in the West seeing it before the virus reached them, the Red Cross appeals published in newspapers, often in half-page advertisements that said, The safety of this country demands that all patriotic available nurses, nurses aides, or anyone with experience in nursing place themselves at once under the disposal of the government. Physicians are urgently requested to release from attendance on chronic cases and all other cases which are not critically ill every nurse working under their direction who can possibly be spared for such duty. Graduate nurses, undergraduates, nurses' aides, and volunteers are urged to telegraph collect at once to their local Red Cross chapter or Red Cross headquarters, Washington, D.C. Don't get scared, said the papers. Be not afraid. But not everyone was ready to trust in God. In 2001, a terrorist attack with anthrax killed 5 people and transfixed America. In 2002, an outbreak of West Nile virus killed 284 people nationally in 6 months and sparked headlines for weeks, along with enough fear to change people's behavior. In 2003, SARS killed over 800 people around the world, froze Asian economies, and frightened millions of people in Hong Kong, Singapore, and elsewhere into wearing masks on the streets. In 1918, fear moved ahead of the virus like the bow wave before a ship. Fear drove the people, and the government and the press could not control it. They could not control it because every true report had been diluted with lies. And the more the officials and newspapers reassured, the more they said there is no cause for alarm if proper precautions are taken, or influenza is nothing more or less than old-fashioned grip, the more people believed themselves cast adrift, adrift with no one to trust, adrift on an ocean of death. So people watched the virus approach and feared, feeling as impotent as it moved toward them as if it were an inexorable oncoming cloud of poison gas. It was 1,000 miles away, 500 miles away, 50 miles away, 20 miles away. In late September, they saw published reports, reports buried in back pages, reports in tiny paragraphs, but reports nonetheless. 800 cases among midshipmen at Annapolis. In New York State, coughing or sneezing without covering the face was now punishable by a year in jail and a $500 fine. 30 cases of influenza among students at the University of Colorado. But, of course, the Associated Press reassured, none of the cases, it was said, is serious. But then it was serious. 400 dead in a day in Philadelphia. 20 dead in Colorado and New Mexico. 400 now dead in Chicago. All social and amusement activities suspended in El Paso, where 7 funerals for soldiers occurred in a single day. It would get much worse. A terrible outbreak in Winslow, Arizona. It was like being bracketed by artillery, the barrage edging closer and closer. In Lincoln, Illinois, a small town 30 miles from Springfield, William Maxwell sensed it. My first intimations about the epidemic was that it was something happening to the troops. There didn't seem to be any reason to think it would ever have anything to do with us. And yet, in a gradual, remorseless way, it kept moving closer and closer. Rumors of the alarming situation reached this very small town in the Midwest. It was like, almost like an entity moving closer. In Meadow, Utah, 100 miles from Provo, Lee Ray recalled, "We were very concerned in our town because it was moving south down the highway, and we were next." They watched it kill in Payson, then Santaquin, then Nephi, Levan, and Mills. They watched it come closer and closer. They put up a huge sign on the road that ordered people to keep going, not to stop in Meadow. But the mailman stopped anyway. Wherever one was in the country, it crept closer. It was in the next town, the next neighborhood, the next block, the next room. In Tucson, the Arizona Daily Star warned readers not to catch Spanish hysteria. Don't worry was the official and final piece of advice on how to avoid the disease from the Arizona Board of Health. Don't get scared, said the newspapers everywhere. Don't get scared, they said in Denver, in Seattle, in Detroit, in Burlington, Vermont, and Burlington, Iowa, and Burlington, North Carolina, in Greenville, Rhode Island, and Greenville, South Carolina, and Greenville, Mississippi. And every time the newspapers said, don't get scared, they frightened. The virus had moved west and south from the East Coast by water and rail. It rose up in great crests to flood cities, rolled in great waves through the towns, broke into wild rivers to rage through villages, poured in swollen creeks through settlements, flowed in tiny rivulets into isolated homes. And as in a great flood, it covered everything, varying in depth, but covering everything, settling over the land in a great leveling. Albert Camus wrote, "What's true of all the evils in the world is true of plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves." One who rose was Dr. Ralph Marshall Ward, who had abandoned medicine for cattle ranching. Leaving medicine had not been a business decision. An intellectual, particularly interested in pharmacology, he was a prominent physician in Kansas City with an office and pharmacy in the Stockyard Exchange Building down by the Bottoms. But Kansas City was a major railhead, with the yards near his office. Most of his practice involved treating railroad workers injured in accidents. He performed huge numbers of amputations and seemed always to work on mangled men, men ripped into pieces by steel. To have a practice with so much human agony ripped him into pieces as well. He had too much of doctoring, and from treating cowboys hurt on cattle drives north to Kansas City, he had learned enough about the cattle business that he decided shortly before the war to buy a small ranch more than 1,000 miles away, near San Benito, Texas, close to the Mexican border. On the long trip south, he and his wife made a pact never to utter a word that he had been a doctor. But in October 1918, influenza reached him. Some ranch hands got ill. He began treating them. Word spread. A few days later, his wife woke up to a disturbing and unrecognizable sound. She went outside and saw out there in the gloaming people, hundreds of people on the horizon. They seemed to cover that horizon, and as they came closer, it was clear they were Mexicans, a few of them on mules, most on foot, women carrying babies. Men carrying women, bedraggled, beaten down, a mass of humanity, a mass of horror and suffering. She yelled for her husband, and he came out and stood on the porch. "Oh, my God," he said. The people had come with nothing, but they knew he was a doctor, so they had come. The Wards later told their granddaughter it was like the hospital scene in Gone with the Wind, with rows of wounded and dying laid out on the ground in agony. These people had come with nothing, had nothing, and they were dying. The Wards took huge pots outside to boil water, used all their resources to feed them, treated them. Out on the empty, harsh range near the Mexican border, they had no Red Cross to turn to for help, no Council of National Defense. They did what they could, and when it was over, they went back to Kansas City. He had already gone back to being a doctor. There were other men and women like the Wards. Physicians, nurses, scientists did their jobs, and the virus killed them. Killed them in such numbers that each week JAMA was filled with literally page after page after page after page after page of nothing but brief obituaries in tiny compressed type. Hundreds of doctors dying. Hundreds. Others helped too. But as Camus knew, evil and crises do not make all men rise above themselves. Crises only make them discover themselves. and some discover a less inspiring humanity. As the crest of the wave that broke over Philadelphia began its sweep across the rest of the country, it was accompanied by the same terror that had silenced the streets there. Most men and women sacrificed and risked their lives only for those they loved most deeply. A child, a wife, a husband. Others, loving chiefly themselves, fled in terror even from them. Still others fomented terror, believing that blaming the enemy, Germany, could help the war effort, or perhaps actually believing that Germany was responsible. Doan himself charged that German agents from submarines brought influenza to the United States. The Germans have started epidemics in Europe, and there is no reason why they should be particularly gentle to America. Others around the country echoed him. Starkville, Mississippi, a town of 3,000 in the Mississippi Hill Country, was built around a sawmill, cotton farms, not the rich, lush plantations of the Delta, but harsh land, and Mississippi A&M College, now Mississippi State University. It served as headquarters for Dr. M.G. Parsons, the U.S. Public Health Service officer for northeastern Mississippi, who proudly informed Blue that he had succeeded in getting local newspapers to run stories he made up that aid in forming a proper frame of mind in the public. That frame of mind was fear. Parsons wanted to create fear, believing it prepared the public mind to receive and act on our suggestions. Parsons got the local press to say, "The Hun resorts to unwanted murder of innocent non-combatants. He has been tempted to spread sickness and death through germs, and has done so in authenticated cases. Communicable diseases are more